Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to yet another episode of the Last Knock Horror Podcast. I am your host, Billy Crash, with you today. And with us, we have a very special guest, thanks to the great Greg Palko of PalkoDesigns.com. It's Mr. Seth Andrews. And if you don't know who this wonderful gentleman is, he is the host of The Thinking Atheist. He has two wonderful books out that I can't wait to pick up, Sacred Cows, and a book about his journey from going from religion to reason. And Seth, how are you, sir?
I'm well, and I'm sure I can live up to your introduction, but you know, you make me sound amazing.
Well, you are.
But thanks. I was greatly appreciated. Thanks for letting me play along. And I always like to say at the very beginning that first thing is, I'm not the thinking atheist. I'm a former Christian broadcaster who came out of a faith culture. And so the thinking atheist is an icon that encourages everyone to use reason and not faith as we navigate the challenges and opportunities before us. And the second thing is that you don't have to be an atheist to participate in the show, because we talk about a lot of different stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons we may be speaking is because I'm a big, you know, ghost stories fan, horror movie fan. And every October we have this sort of annual tradition where I put together at least an hour, if not 90-minute long compilation of ghost stories, including an original work, and produce the hell out of it. And we just sit around the virtual campfire and I tell everybody, shut the lights off and let's sort of scare the crap out of each other. And hopefully, if I've done my job right, you get goosebumps at least four or five times a show.
So. Nice. That's great. In fact, that's funny. I'm glad, you know, maybe we'll lead with that. Well, first of all, before we go into what I would like, is there anything you need to say about atheism, like in case there's anything that needs to be demystified or something like that?
Well, yeah, it's amazing how many people are curious about atheists, but they may be afraid to ask, or they're aware of the label, a perception of what atheism is. And I used to be that way. You know, the atheist was the other. How could someone, how could a godless person have any quality of life? And I never, ever would have thought I would ever walk away from my Christian faith. Mm-hmm. I was a true blue, 100% believer. I mean, all in believer. Wow. And in my 30s, I started to finally get into a more courageous, hopefully I'll say courageous, examination, where I wasn't afraid as much to challenge the sacred cows, you know? Who was it who said, it was Dale McGowan, who's a tremendous man, who said, you come to that moment in your life when your desire to know becomes greater than your desire to believe. Mm. And in my 30s, I came to this moment where I was like, my desire to know who wrote the Bible and where the scriptures came from and what they actually say and the history of Christianity and the evidence or lack of for gods and miracles and the supernatural and heaven and hell. I want to know. And my desire to know is now greater than my desire to believe. And that's a scary place to be, man. You know, after decades in the faith, I just started to tap on the glass. And it's amazing when you start asking questions, when you're not afraid of the answer. And by the end of that journey, I realized that there was no there. There just wasn't anything. There wasn't anything that I could hold to as factual or true. And beyond that, honestly, I realized that life in the real world lived as a rationalist is actually a more satisfying life. Mm. And so while I enjoy, you know, fiction and fantasy and horror and, you know, I'll get into Harry Potter as much as anybody else. I enjoy, you know, the theater of the imagination. Right. When it comes to the challenges and opportunities that we face as human beings, I think we have to root ourselves in science, reason, and the evidence. And that's kind of my shtick, and that's what I've been doing since 2009.
Nice. No, congratulations, because I started questioning when I was in high school.
You're much smarter than I am. That's why you got there sooner. I beat myself up. Like, how the hell did it take me till I was in my late 30s before I finally got there? But good for you.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it is simple fear. It's like, well, what happens when we're dead? You know, I think it's that simple. And
I don't want to go to hell. That was a big thing for me.
Sure. Well, I don't know. I heard the parties are good there, so I was, you know, a little concerned. But actually, I had a dream once, and it's funny. I remember it as if it was reality. I had a dream where I had died, trying to get into heaven, but it was closed because it was too late at night, something like that. So these two guys are trying to help me over the wall, and as I'm climbing over, all I hear is Muskrat Love from Captain and Tennille. So I climb down. I'm like, forget that. Next thing, I'm on an elevator going to hell because I'm the one guy was next to me, and he's like, what are we doing? He said, well, the Sex Pistols are playing. And he's like, that's Jesus behind us. And I said, yeah, I think he's going too. So that was the whole dream. It was just so bizarre.
Hell for the climate. Or wait, heaven for the climate, hell for the company. I think that's what they always used to say. Yeah. Dude, this is a lot of people. I've mentioned this on the show, but I, from time to time, about twice a year, I don't know if you know about sleep paralysis. I'm sure probably talked,
yes.
Right?
Night terrors.
Where you are wired, your body is paralyzed for dream sleep, but you're actually on the cusp of consciousness and you sense a presence in the room and you panic because you cannot move. Mm-hmm. And this happens to me a couple of times a year. And Natalie's always there to kind of nudge me. Hey, wake up. And it used to freak me out. And of course, in a spiritual context, I used to really wonder, you know, who was in the room? Was it a dark presence?
Right.
You know, was it the devil? That kind of thing, you know? And of course, now, you know, understanding, and that's a great example of understanding the brain and the science of sleep paralysis and night terrors and how all of that works physically in the machine of the human body and brain. You realize it becomes more of a forensic thing. When it happens, you're like, oh, shit, this is happening.
Yeah.
And so I guess I need to, you know, hopefully Natalie will reach over and tap me and wake me up. Not I'm being visited by Beelzebub. So that's kind of a good, that's an assuring thing to know when you're experiencing a night terror. I'm just saying.
Sure. Did you see the documentary? What is it? The Nightmare? Did you see
it? Yeah, I did. I did. And I liked the first part of it. What frustrated me about, and it was produced by the same director, a production company that did Room 237, which is another wild ride. But The Nightmare, for me, missed a tremendous opportunity to educate the viewer about the science of sleep paralysis. And I'm not saying you have to make it a freaking C-SPAN documentary, but what they did was just one reenactment after the other of these people who had been traumatized by the feeling of the presence, and they nailed it. The idea of the shape with the fangs and the blurry vision, and you're panicked, you can't breathe, there's something crushing your chest. They nailed it. And for 30, 45 minutes, I'm watching with Natalie and I got goosebumps because I'm like, it's like they crawled in my skull.
Mm-hmm.
But now where are you going to go with it? And instead of getting us into, well, here's what it is, here's why it is, here's the percentage of people it happens to, here's, you know, a way sort of through or a way of a better understanding this whole phenomenon, they just kept doing examples of people who got the crap scared out of them when they went to bed. And I felt like the last half of the film was a wasted opportunity.
Agreed.
We actually, a couple of years ago on the Ghost Stories broadcast, did a whole section on sleep paralysis, giving the listeners the education that the documentary did not. But if you want to know what it's like, watch the first 45 minutes and with the lights off, and you will get you will get what people with sleep paralysis experience when they have night terrors. It's really chilling stuff.
It is chilling. I haven't had that experience, but, you know, seeing what those people went through, what they experienced, and what some are experiencing on a regular basis, it's sobering. It's so frightening. So in that regard, you know, thinking about, you know, this fanged creature coming through at the night, and, you know, you're talking about ghost stories. Are ghost stories like your favorite subgenre of horror?
Yeah, well, I'm not a horror snob. And
you're
really
safe
not.
Here, man. You're safe.
Okay, all right, say
what you want.
Apologize.
Yeah, don't.
I'm one of those people that, you know, like many times, and this is why radio works so well for me, is that it's what you don't see or what you don't yet see that scares you. The best horror gets in your own head before you turn the corner, before you turn the doorknob, before you look under the bed, before you go near the closet. The best horror already has you talking to yourself or to the screen or to the radio or whatever, to the book, before the next event happens.
Agreed.
And what happens in my mind is that I find a lot of horror producers compensate for a lack of imagination by just simply pouring on the gore or the jump scares, easy shocks. And you know, those are fine and they can be effective. But my favorite stories are the ones that really just get inside your skull without having to pour the buckets of blood. And then when those romps do happen, like the Evil Dead series, which are near perfection, right? Agreed. And they're over the top gore. When those things happen, they are what they are. You know, that's a whole other thing. But really getting under your skin, giving you the goosebumps, you know, the original Halloween, when it released in 1979, had almost no blood in it. Correct. And you see almost none of the violence. It's what you don't see. It's what you anticipate that keeps you up at night. And when that thing released, there were people who just, I mean, it was before we'd become jaded by four decades of horror movies. And at the end, he's gone, right? It was one of the first where the killer was out there, and then the credits roll, and you have to go home that night knowing that Michael Myers is out there. Before he became a cliche, it really terrified people for a reason. And it's a great example of how you can use atmosphere, music, pauses, what you don't see sometimes to get people on the edge of their seats and really get in their skulls.
Yeah, absolutely. That was actually, we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of Halloween, so it's 1970.
You know, they're making Nick Castle, as I understand it, who is the guy in the mask in the original version, John Carpenter's version, is coming back for the 40-year version with Jamie Lee Curtis to release in October of this year.
Yep.
And I know people are saying it's a cash grab, but I can't wait. I cannot wait to go see this movie.
No, I agree with you. I'm excited about it as well.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Fantastic. And, you know, it may suck, but I'll be there opening weekend. Look, I saw, not to, you know, is what happens when you get a radio host on the show, as I tend to blather on.
But go ahead. I'm taking a nap. It's fine. Go ahead.
Buddy of mine across the street, he lived across the street in a house behind a house when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. We saw Halloween. I saw it for the first time on his VHS tape. And you know how it is. You're awesome and you're courageous and you're really brave during the day. And then the sun goes down and then you have to try to go to bed that night. Well, I actually walked to his house and we watched Halloween, scared the crap out of me, just totally got under my skin. Mm-hmm. And I had to walk home from Tony's house to my own. And it is the most vulnerable I think I've ever felt in my life. I mean, I was just running, you know, looking all around me. My imagination was still in full kick. This is what good storytellers do.
Agreed.
And it's always my goal whenever we're doing the ghost stories, and I'm working actually on a ghost stories audiobook for audible.com for release in September. That's one of the criteria, is that will it spell out the obvious and waste everybody's time, or will we give them enough so that the brain fills in the rest and now we're all taking the journey together?
And that's
the goal.
No, well, I'm sure you'll achieve it. I mean, you know, knowing how you think, because the one movie that does it for me, Halloween never got to me because the music always gave things away, but Oren Peli's Paranormal Activity, if I were to watch it today in the daylight, tonight I wouldn't be able to walk up the stairs in the dark to my bedroom. I wouldn't be able to do it.
They shot that thing for less than I paid for my stepdaughter's used car, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
They shot the whole thing for like $5,000 or whatever in this guy's, in the director's house.
It was, he had a $15,000 budget and $7,500 went to making his house look better. And so it was pretty much $7,500 and they made it work because I was that focused that captured my, I had nightmares as a child of disembodied voices, of things touching me that I couldn't see. And I mean, I was freaking out as a kid like you couldn't imagine. My parents would always, you know, check on me at night and I wouldn't be in bed. I'd be sleeping under the bed, in the closet, under their bed, somewhere else. So it really plagued me, and that movie just brought all of that right back, you know.
I think some of the scariest stuff too is the stuff where it could happen to me. So you know, the more abstract we get, I mean, that's a whole other playground. But you know, it's sticking your fingers under the crease in the door and not knowing what's on the other side. It's looking under the bed. It's when there's, I went over and I have a buddy of mine, Corey, lives in Dallas, and he does Halloween huge time at his house every single year.
Nice.
And it was funny because he keeps this witch. He's got this big life-size witch, and he keeps it in the guest room closet. So it's after Halloween. He's got everything in storage, and I go to stay at his place, and of course the lights are off, and I'm trying to sleep with this shape with the witch's hat, no eyes, just the outline, and the closet door is cracked just enough. And of course I'm like, oh hell no. I get up, and I close the door.
Yeah, sure.
You know, because you know it walks around in the middle of the night, and I just don't need that in my life.
Yeah,
I'm just saying.
Yeah, that and creepy dolls, all that stuff. We know it comes to life.
Yeah, it's true.
But in regard to ghost stories, you know, since whether it's in horror or you mentioned like Ghost Hunters before, just paranormal shows, it's almost like they're not trying to necessarily prove that like ghosts exist necessarily, but it's like, well, if we could prove that ghosts exist, then, we have a spiritual entity that's walking around, then this is proof of life after death.
I buy that.
Yeah.
Now,
okay. Please.
One thing about the Ghost Hunter shows that has marked my brain is that these quite often are the stupidest people. I mean... Ghost Adventures, is that what it's called?
Ooh,
with
yeah,
the big muscular guy.
Yeah, I can't take that one, man. No.
They walk in and they're like, look, there's an orb on the camera right here. Oh, we got a cold spot right here. And then they'll just take whatever leap is possible. I'm like,
sure.
The truth is that I want a PhD who understands, atmospheric conditions, meteorology, basic physics. I want a real skeptic to go in there and do that.
Sure.
And while those shows are fun, there used to be a show, don't laugh, it was called The Scariest Places on Earth.
Yes.
You remember it? With
yes,
Linda Blair hosting?
Oh my gosh, yeah, that was a long time ago, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and they would send these families, like families would nominate themselves, and they would send them off to these haunted castles, like Dracula's castle, and then they'd shut all the lights off, and they'd put everybody in a different part of the castle. And then they would just leave them and give them specific tasks to do, sometimes in total darkness in what felt like a mausoleum.
Mm-hmm.
And so, every sound, every noise, every creature, every, rodent that's cruising along. Look, I'm a straight up atheist. That would wig me out. But I would love to try it because
sure.
I think you got like 10 grand if you lasted through the night without everybody.
Yeah. So, it was almost like the House on Haunted Hill for real,
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just go and try not to get in your own head. Just keep breathing. Try to let the rational override the irrational. But, I mean, how hard would that be? You're in the basement. You're down in the dungeon. They took some people to, like, a prison, so complete with electric chair and old gurneys that are all laying around. And I'm telling you, that stuff will just flat wig you out.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to try it just to see, how I'd operate under stress. I'd like to try it.
Well, I was in Eastern State Penitentiary, which is outside of, which is in Philadelphia, and it was the first modern penitentiary. It's built in 1856. It had plumbing before the White House had plumbing and all of that stuff. And I was there in the daylight with a tour group for photography, and that creeped me out in the daylight. And I was with people, and I couldn't imagine being there alone at night because I knew my mind would just go nuts.
Yeah.
And I would just be my own worst enemy and just scare myself to death,
Does the fact that you've seen so many horror movies help or hurt when you're in that environment? Like, do you think, well, I know how not to die? or do you see the gurney or the empty wheelchair in the corner or whatever? And do you then recall when some horrible event took place around that icon and now you're totally screwed up? I'm just curious.
Well, that's a good question because sometimes I think like, man, all the horror movies I watch, 95% of the people die. It's like, what did I really learn? they usually don't make it, a true horror movie doesn't have that happy ending unless it's like a commercial horror film, that kid's going to survive. But, everybody else is fair game. And I think that's why I like the movie The Ring the most, it's like the American version anyway, when, Samara, when the mother played by Naomi Watts, helped her, so to speak. And her son's like, why did you help her? What are you doing? It's like, it's not going to do anything,
Yeah.
And that was it. It's like, what can you really do against a a spiritual force that's relentless and, you know, single-minded, you know?
I think supernatural ideas can be genuinely scary. It's don't mock me, but like the first, the first 80% of The Conjuring, I hated the ending of The Conjuring.
So did I.
Okay. But the first portion, the first half to 80% of The Conjuring is actually, in my opinion, quite good because it plays on so many basic fears. Sure. The fear of your loved ones in danger, the fear of dark places and unknown spaces, the fear of home becoming the unsafe place. Oh. And of course, you know, you get into the basement with all of the different icons and the ball bouncing out of the dark and all of that stuff, right? And the film, not Annabelle, the first Annabelle film, but Annabelle Creation, which released late last year, is actually a really effective, scary movie.
Oh, I'll put that on my list. I wrote it off because of the first one was so
No. Skip the first one. It does not exist. Wipe it from your memory. All right. Call the historians. Just let them white out that sucker because it's awful. Annabelle Creation is actually really, really good. And it's a really effective film that does exactly what we were talking about before. Mm-hmm. Without beating you over the head with a baseball bat, without being master of the obvious, it actually gets inside your skull and does the doll thing right. Because doll's easy to screw up.
Oh, yeah.
It's easy to make it so it's campy or stupid or cliche. And what they did was you see, you know, an example that's not giving anything away is, you know, you're looking through the keyhole and you see Annabelle, the doll face. And you look away and you come back. Now you have not seen the doll's face actually move, but the doll is now in a different position. Mm-hmm. And if you do that right, the not seeing the motion is actually more terrifying. And there's a ton of that stuff in Annabelle Creation.
Ooh,
it's
okay.
Quite well done. Very well done.
Ooh, well, man, I'm putting that, man, I might watch that tonight now.
Yeah. I'm serious. And you call me, I'll give you a refund if you hate it.
Well, I think that's one of the things that, you know, we look for in horror movies is to, you know, yeah, we do want to get a jolt and all, but, you know, there's just something about that feeling of hopelessness. And I don't know, for me, sometimes when I see a horror movie and it's like so mind-numbing, draining, it makes me feel better about my existence, you know?
My wife asked me why. Like, what's wrong with you? Are you sick? Are you sick, man? And of course, you know, she'll walk in when we're watching Ash versus Evil Dead or something way over the top, that's a whole other ballgame.
Oh yeah.
But you know, she wants, you know, the guy and the girl get together at the end and everybody gets a snow cone and the music plays and she loves comedy, you know, and so
yeah.
So I'm always having to be like, I try not to drag her to too many horror movies, but from time to time I'm like, you know, I you're my date. Like, I don't want to go by myself. And she'd be like, okay, you know, and so we'll hop in and we'll go. But she'll ask me, like, what's the attraction for you? And I always tell her it's like I hate thrill rides. I'm terrified of them. I'm very motion sick. But I think that one of the attractions of people like who ride the Texas Giant at Six Flags or whatever, you know, Superman or Batman, wherever those rides are, is they are able to have the illusion of danger while being completely safe. And at the end, after that adrenaline kick, everybody laughs and walks away with a story. And a good horror movie is very much the same way. Yes, you're going to very dark places. Yes, your heart's racing. Yes, your palms are sweating. Yes, you're screaming in the theater at all the different things that are going on. But it's you are doing so knowing, with your rational mind, knowing you're in a safe place and this is just a ride. And at the end of the ride, you can all high five and say, hey, we made it, man. Yeah. That was wild. It was awesome. And then you can go talk about it on podcasts like this one.
Right. Right.
And she kind of gets that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I took her to go see the first Sinister, which was actually, despite the fact that the family acts so illogically, despite all of that, I still love that movie. I don't know what your take on it was.
Yeah, that's the way. Yeah.
Didn't care for it.
No.
Was it the illogic of Ethan Hawke's character for the entire film, or was it something else? Was it just not spooky?
No, it was spooky, but like a lot of movies like that for me lose it in the third act. They become a little convoluted or they try too hard. And once I start seeing the same tropes over and over and over again, it just, kills it for me, and that's what it did. I want
well, that's what happened to The Conjuring, in my opinion. I think
same
they
thing. Yeah, exactly.
Just all of a sudden, it just became like, oh, it's the third act. It's time for us to ramp up. Let's do a little action. Everybody starts to be everything feels more self-conscious.
Yeah, and more contrived. But, yeah.
I didn't see the sequel to Sinister. I heard it was terrible, so I just skipped it outright. But I thought the first one, you know, talk about a feeling of dread and you know, you really walk out of that movie looking for oxygen. you know, you're looking for lighter air to breathe. Like, oh man.
Yeah. Well, again, I think it's you know, it's with any film. You know, you bring your life experiences to whatever's on screen. Like with any art, you know, you bring those life experiences and. Depending on what you're bringing to it, it's what you're going to get from it. So, like, I know, because I know a lot of people, you know, like, you know, to reference Paranormal Activity again for me, I know a lot of people think, oh, man, I was stupid, nothing happened, I was bored. And meanwhile, my heart is in my stomach and, you know, I'm freaking out.
Yeah.
Just because of what I experienced. So,
I think in radio, we used to call it a relate. And I think if get someone to be like, I can relate to what's happening. So, you know, a sound in another part of your house that you cannot identify is an automatic relate mm-hmm. for all of us. And it speaks to us on a number of levels, our own safety, the safety of our family, you know, the unknown. And I don't mind surrendering to the supernatural in those contexts. For me, it's the same as going to see a Harry Potter film or something like that. I mean, you know, you're checking your at the door, you're going to check sort of reality. You're strapping sure. yourself in and saying, I now give you permission to take me on this to this other world.
Right.
Or I will suspend disbelief and I'm going to. And, you know, if you do it right, I'm all in, you know. And so as I found many of my friends who are non-believers in the supernatural in real life are some of the most fervent fans of supernatural fiction. Mm. It's a playground for the imagination. It's great fun to participate in. So,
no, I understand completely. I think that's one of the powers of, you know, I watch a lot of Asian, I watch a lot of foreign horror cinema. And usually when I watch a foreign film out of Asia, I know there's a pretty good chance it's going to be a ghost story because it's so prevalent in their culture. The ghost with a grudge that comes back, you know, and it's like everybody's screwed pretty much. But
are they subtitled? Are they mostly, I mean, is it an atmospheric thing and you're able to take the journey even while you're reading the film? Or?
Yeah, I've gotten so used to reading movies, you know, I hate to put it that way, but I need to feel, I need the actor's real emotion through their real voices. I need to hear, you know, that timbre. I need to hear the rhythm of the words in their native tongue. And I hate dubbed films. If it's,
I do too.
Yeah, I can't. It to me, it just destroys it. But
just destroys it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, a lot of those, I think a lot of those spiritual-based movies, especially, you know, with ghosts and all, are, you know, you have that element where, and I've read this before in research papers, that some research scientists feel that people love horror movies because not just, you know, to get that jolt, but also to, you know, because it helps them cope with a fear of death. But I also see a lot of people who love ghost movies and follow actually paranormal films of, you know, paranormal shows where they're, you know, ghost hunting because they want that proof. They want this proof that there's something beyond this physical world when it's over for them. And
I used to be that guy. I used to follow those shows and I mean, I didn't fall for every grain of dust that drifted in front of a camera lens.
Yeah.
You know, oh, look, it looks like it has agency. It's direct change direction as it flew by. I was never that guy. And I never bought like the divining rods and, you know, bringing in the druid priest to walk around and all. Right. I mean, I never bought any of that, but I was genuinely interested in the stuff that could not be explained. You take a photograph and you see not just a shape or a pattern, but an actual face in the window. That kind of thing really did resonate with me. And I was in a weird spot because there was a part of me that wanted to know for sure. Like, I'd like it to be proven. Right. And there was also another part of me that treated it a little bit like you treat Loch Ness, like the Loch Ness monster. I wouldn't want to know. Like, I don't want to know that it doesn't exist for sure because there's a fun part of me that's like, the not knowing 100, not having explored every square foot of Loch Ness.
Yes, exactly.
You know, it actually allows this to stay alive in my imagination. Don't kill my dream, kind of thing. And these shows actually, so it was a weird, there was a part of me that wanted to know for sure, and another part of me that, well, I'd like to know, but not all the way, you know?
Yes.
I don't solve it definitively. I used to be that guy.
No, I understand what you mean exactly, because it's almost like without mystery, it's like, well, there's no fun left, you know?
Yeah, I understand.
So how did you, once you made that transition from I'm wondering if there was a change in how you viewed horror movies, because you went from being a Christian, believing in a spiritual life after this physical one, to not, and you're watching horror films. Did they lose an effect? Did they still have the same effect? Or,
well, it was different. I saw The Exorcist on video. I was still living at home in the living room of my parents' house at like 1 a.m. I was working nights. I was a night owl, and I'd never seen it. And and so I'm like, all right, let's go see what all the fuss is about. And at this point, I mean, it's in the 80s. It's been out a while, right? I think The Exorcist released in 73, something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd heard the stories of people who ran out of the theater and people who had been influenced or had demonic influence in their lives because of the influence of the film, and the film itself was cursed, and so-and-so died in an accident, and so-and-so got cancer, and we hear all these stories. We heard some of the same stuff about the Poltergeist film.
I was just going to say that, absolutely, totally.
And but as a believer at the time in God and the devil, in demons and demon possession, The Exorcist hit me in a primal way. It wasn't just I was caught up in the story. I really did, even though I finished the film and watched all the way through by myself at that time as a youth, I remember thinking, I'm playing with fire. This is, you know, is this really something I should be seeing? Is this providing a conduit for, you know, sort of dark magic in my own life? Have I allowed this stuff to become part of my own psyche by allowing it into my eyes and ears? And this was, of course, during the satanic panic of the 1980s when everything was called demonic. You know, they're playing rock albums backwards, and they were telling us that cartoons were of the devil, and people were burning books at church services, and you had the, you know, Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan on Donahue, and everybody's freaking out about Satan, Satan, Satan. The McMartin trial happened in the 80s with the child abuse. All that stuff played
that crazy.
This culture of fear about the devil and demonic stuff, and and it was different, you know, it was just different, and it was scary in that way at that moment, to a degree, because I felt like this stuff happens. Exorcisms are sometimes real and needed. Demons are real entities that do possess human bodies, and there is a hell. If you tamper with this stuff, you can lose your immortal soul and writhe forever. And that added a whole other layer for me, I remember. And it's interesting watching those films. Some of it's just because I've been jaded by decades of other films and learning more about sort of the construction of the storytelling. But watching it again, I now see it as more of, it's almost more of like a cultural marker. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You're like, oh, well, you know, I remember when the 70s, when people ran screaming out of the theater and were throwing up in the lobby and they were doing all that. I remember those stories. And this was made, and this was really groundbreaking for its time. And this was really considered sacrilegious when she did the thing with the crucifix. And it's a different conversation now, because I look back more forensically at how the filmmakers were able to terrify a generation that was already predisposed to be afraid of demons and the devil. And you know, now it's more of a, I don't know, I'm more amused by it than anything else. I still really respect the film. It's a very well-made film, especially for its time. But I can go see a movie about a ghost or a spirit or a devil or whatever, and I can still get creeped out, but it's different. It's not like I feel like that by watching this, I'm dancing with the devil.
Right.
Instead, it's that I've surrendered my, you know, my disbelief, so to speak. I've now given the movie producers permission to take me on this journey, and I'm willing to go on the ride. And, you know, sometimes that ride can be really spooky, even when you know it's not real.
Boy, that's the truth. Yeah, William Friedkin, he worked really hard to make The Exorcist resonate, because, like, if you think about it, it should have been like a B movie, but it wasn't, you know. Quality acting and, you know, the cinematography alone, and to see this child in crisis. And it's like, and you love her and hate her at the same time, because it's like, oh man, that poor kid. But man, you know, she's like a demon now, so to hell with her. You know, she's destroying people's lives.
You see the corruption of innocence in front of your very eyes, and you think,
absolutely,
this could happen. Like, this could happen somewhere. And you think about the Catholic Church and the thousands of exorcisms performed and the reports of demon possession. And
sure,
man, especially if you buy into that stuff, it's, you know, I can imagine how it would totally ring your bell.
Yeah, but the one thing that got me early on about, you know, demonic possession was I've seen, you know, countless films and heard countless stories. Usually it involves a young girl, and she's usually tied spread eagle to the bed. And, you know, this demon's inside her, spewing all this stuff, speaking in tongues, and, you know, doing all these crazy things. But this demon, for some reason, can't untie itself from the bed. You know, it's like, so I'm sitting there, you know, I'm sitting there in my youth watching this stuff, and I'm like, something's wrong here, because, like, they should be, you know, instead of making the bed going up and down and throwing up green vomit, they should, you know, be, look, I untied myself. You're screwed now. But that never happened, you know.
One of my favorite films involving exorcisms is actually not a horror movie, but it's called Constantine, starring Keanu Reeves.
Yes, yes. I love that movie. I admit.
I love that movie. And there's a great exorcism in the opening segment. And,
yes,
you know, he has to do all these stunts to try to get the demon out. And it's always such hard work. And, of course, I was raised, and this is, again, this is the mind compartmentalizing, but I was raised to believe that Yahweh, God, Jesus, mm-hmm, the most powerful creature, there's no comparison. God's power trumps Satan's power.
Sure.
And yet, it always seemed like it took so much freaking effort for the priests and the preachers to get the demon out of the body. Like, I'm thinking to myself, this should be just come out and it's over. Like, all you need is for God to show up, snap his fingers, do whatever he's going to do, say the magic incantation, wink at you, whatever God decides needs to be done, to take about 3 seconds. And instead, it's like exorcisms going on for what, days and weeks? And they're so traumatic. And I thought, well, if God is genuinely much more powerful than Satan and his minions, why is this taking so long? It never made sense to me.
No, it doesn't. But one of the things that I know they weave into most of those stories is the priest, the holy man, whatever, is having a crisis of faith. So that's like part of the thing where it's like, well, maybe it's not working because this human conduit just isn't fully invested, you know, spiritually yet. So, you know, and usually they gain their faith afterwards, something to that effect. And so maybe that's it. Maybe that's the caveat. That's the little way out for something like that, taking days. I forgot the name of it offhand. It was very sobering. It's not a horror, but it was a drama of this German girl who her family thought she was possessed, and they did an exorcism, and she actually died of malnutrition because the exorcism went on forever, and they refused her food and drink, and it was just like so sad, you know, they couldn't see beyond their faith, and that maybe she's just a daughter with certain issues that, you know, she needed just a therapist, you know.
And this is, I think, one of the reasons why we want to encourage people to reject the notions of faith. I know it's not culturally popular to say that, because faith is the mm-hmm. stuff that people have been conditioned to believe, that, you know, if you're a man of faith, you know, we often see it on politicians' advertisements, you know, he's a man of faith, she's a woman of faith.
Exactly.
And this is a compliment. But I think, you know, if somebody, you know, if someone told you to get on an airplane and you said, is the pilot qualified? And they said, take it on faith. Well, you know, you'd probably want greater assurance than that. If
I do. I have a fear of flying.
You know, it people, and also it's interesting to watch people of one faith or religious belief,
right,
using the faith criteria in their own circle, but refusing it to others. So if you go to a mm-hmm. Christian and you say, look, we'd like you to believe in Allah and the book, the Quran and in Islam on faith, they say, well, no, I'm not going to do that. I need you to prove it to me. And mm-hmm. if you go to the Islamist and you say, I'd like you to be a Scientologist, take it on faith, they'd say, absolutely not. So it's like faith in my life, facts in yours. I get faith. Mm-hmm. You have to bring facts. Dr. John Loftus has a book called The Outsider Test for Faith, where he actually talks about how that a lot of religious cultures have done a great job of debunking all the other religious cultures outside of themselves. You can actually read a lot of their own work,
right,
and see, well, they've actually gone through and done a lot of the heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if these parents of this poor child who had died had actually rooted themselves in the real world, in science and medicine, perhaps mental health, I'm not sure what the story was with this particular case, but if they had not sort of held to this superstitious notion that it was a demon causing all the problems, this precious life might have been saved and the child might be alive. And that's part of why I do what I do. And if you want to hold right. a personal religious belief, knock yourself out. I mean, if someone wants to be a person who says I'm spiritual and all that, but you know, you don't get to harm other people and you don't get to force it down other people's throats. And right. often, you know, this stuff is outward rippling. I mean, this child was affected by the religious belief of their parents, of her parents, and therefore it negatively affected her. Allow her to decide, you know, what she thinks and how she thinks it.
No, I agree. And I think that's a beautiful thing, too, if people aren't familiar with your site and some of the wonderful, I guess I would say, you know, mini documentaries that you've produced. They're wonderful, by the way. They're well executed. You know, the editing is perfect, narration, but, you know, The Thinking Atheist is not an attack forum by any means. It's more of
no,
like,
it's not. We love people. I love people.
I know you do.
I mean, I love most people. Let me say that.
I love like dogs more than people sometimes.
Except for with a few exceptions, I love people. You know, it's having been a religious person. I was talking to Tracy Harris, who's one of the hosts of a show in Texas called The Atheist Experience. Mm-hmm. And there's this line that some people say that, you know, religious people are all mentally ill. And I just despise it because I'm like, no. I was a victim of bad ideas. I was, you know, part of a family and culture that held to a specific faith. If you want to know what people believe religiously, there's a good chance you can look at family and geography to know. You know, if they're in Mexico, a good chance it's going to be Catholic. If they're in Syria, there's a good chance they're Islam. If they mm-hmm. are, you know, you can get into denominations. If they're in Minnesota, there's a good chance they're Catholic or Lutheran, for Pete's sake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you can really see the patterns and the inherited belief and whatnot. But these aren't stupid people. They're tremendously, often very smart people. They're simply products of family and culture. And one thing about being a believer and a former Christian broadcaster in my own life, and I'm married to a religious person. I mean, Natalie, she's not a churchgoer, but she believes in God.
Right.
And, you know, I'm able to remind everybody that, you know, you're not better than them. We want to find better ideas, whatever those are. They're not brain damaged. They're not stupid. Many of them are just, they're simply products of their culture. And sure. we're in the arena of ideas. And, you know, let's stop treating this with this sort of superior, nauseatingly condescending tone that some atheists can be very guilty of. And let's start treating each other like human beings. Let's empathize, get to know each other. Let's be able to talk to each other over coffee, even though we disagree about things passionately. And, you know, if we're human beings first, I think that's an important first step.
Oh, agreed. No, that's why I mean, I was looking at some of the comments on some of your videos, and they were from Christian people, and it was just really, it was nice. It was just everybody was just level-headed and, like, you know, discussing ideas, discussing what they, you know, had seen, and not, you know, going, not, you know, getting into attack mode or.
There's some attacks on it.
No, I know, but
spend
I
a lot of time in the comment sections, my friend. I mean, have you noticed?
Yeah,
comment sections are often where discourse goes to die. Yeah. I just can't take it. I die inside sometimes.
Oh,
so.
Man. I can imagine. But, you know, I just saw some really good comments from stable people. And that's what
I'm glad to hear that.
That's what good. I like to see. You know, actually, the movie I was thinking of is it's based on the life of Elizabeth Anneliese Michel. She was a German woman who underwent a Catholic exorcism the year before her death. So this went on for many, many months. They did the exorcism of Emily Rose based on that, of, you know, the child died. So, but there was a German film, actually, that's a dramatic release. A film of it. And that's the title I can't find right now, but I remember it was a very chilling movie to watch.
I know there's a few films. I haven't seen a lot of, like, there's The Last Exorcism and some other stuff, but I haven't seen The Exorcism of Emily Rose. I don't know if it's worth seeing.
Yeah, it didn't work for me, but The Last Exorcism was interesting. It's intriguing. You might want to check that out. I'd be interested to hear what you think of that one.
All right.
Knowing where you've come from and where you've gone to.
But, yeah. So
what other horror films are there that, you know, resonate with you or have, or maybe lost their power over time because of...
well, you and I live in this... you know, the problem is I'm starting to talk more and more like my parents, right? I mean, I'm 50, okay? So I'm like, when I was a kid, we had these... Back when I was a child. and so I try not to turn everybody off at the beginning. But one thing about watching horror films in the 70s and 80s is that you have a greater frame of reference for a lot of what is being borrowed or stolen even today. We're seeing, of course, the dearth of imagination in the storytelling of Hollywood as they continue to remake and reboot and remake and reboot, which in some cases I'll take the journey. I'm one of those weird people who loved the J.J. Abrams reboot of Star Trek with Chris Pine. And I'm a Captain Kirk guy. I'm a Kirk, Spock, McCoy, classic Trek kind of cat. And I thought it was sacrilege when they were, are you going to recast Captain Kirk? You can't do that. I refuse to. I will not. This is an abomination before man. And so I thought, you know, they have reinvented Star Trek, classic Trek, in this way for a whole new generation.
Yeah, exactly.
And they've provided a great platform to tell more stories. I get that. It didn't feel like they were just milking it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I saw the Friday the 13th remake that came out in 2000,
whatever it was.
Awful. It was awful. Like, it, for lack of a better word, it lacks the spirit of what made the original films entertaining. You know, you're not yelling at the screen going, don't go in there, which is the mark of any good Jason film, right? The audience should be saying, don't tell them that you're going to go get the others. Don't walk in that room. Don't go drive. Don't go down that road. Don't go skinny dipping. Don't have sex in this cabin.
I'm just going to say that.
Right? You're yelling and you are involved in the film.
Yeah.
Friday the 13th as a reboot. Totally missed it. They missed the spirit of what made the original Jason films and Mrs. Voorhees film scary and fun to begin with, right? They were sort of the anti-Halloween, because where Halloween had very little blood and gore, Friday the 13th said, hey, let's just pour it on in buckets and kind of see what happens later. Let's turn this screw as far as we can. There is one reboot that I thought was actually extremely well done.
Ooh.
And I'm going to catch hell for this, but I thought the remake of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was actually quite well done. And I'm a big fan of the first film from 1970, the Tobe Hooper movie.
Yeah, but you're not alone. A lot of people I know have really, you know, enjoyed that. I didn't mind it either. I didn't, you know. So, yeah, I understand where you're coming from, because it was well executed. There was good acting, and I loved some of the cinematography. But, you know, they kept the energy up, and I think that's key in a movie like that.
It made you feel like you were watching a relative of the original film, like that these two are, you know, they share common ancestry, if I can get into sort of evolutionary terms.
Sure.
They're part of the same family. They kind of belong to each other, but this is sort of something that it's been being presented for the children of, you know, the 90s and 2000, 2010. And I bought it. Sequels, no, I skipped them. I'm not interested. I heard they were terrible anyway. I think I was burned by Texas Chainsaw 2 back in 1986. Oh my God, that's a horrible movie.
That is a train wreck. It's awful.
Let me back up. Now, there is a documentary on Netflix called Electric Boogaloo, The Wild, Weird Story of Canon Films.
Now, Canon Films. Oh, Canon's
Canon
awesome.
Films is the company that bought the rights to Texas Chainsaw and brought Tobe Hooper back because they wanted a horror film. Now, I can't get into all of Canon Films, but just know that for about 15 years, they made some of the wackiest stuff ever produced on film ever. Just bizarre. Agreed. And the documentary is hysterical. And it gets into the Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2. And so Golan Globus bring in Tobe Hooper and they're like, we want to do another Texas Chainsaw. They contracted him to make a horror movie. And then he went off in his old playground and they didn't know anything about what he was doing. Right? They just figured, oh, we'll see you in 6 months with a horror movie.
Little did they know.
He comes back with a comedy. And he's like, well, I've already done the horror thing. I'm not interested in that. I thought I'd make something kind of funny. And where the first one didn't have that much actual blood in it, I decided to ramp that up. And he just screwed up his own creation and made this abomination, this terrible film. Terrible film. And he came back, and of course Canon's like, what the hell's this? This is crap. And they released it, of course, anyway.
Of course. They had no choice.
So after really all that, I'm off of Chainsaw sequels. I'm not doing it. I don't know. There's some hidden gems out there. Like there's a film with Bill Paxton that I love called Frailty. He directed it.
That's fantastic. Well, man, and oh my gosh. How did you feel watching that one with the religious foundation of it all?
Yeah, it's one of those films that I think
it's brilliant. It's one of my favorite horrors.
That you can shoot it for a buck and a half with a good storyteller.
Yep.
And an innovative concept and people will go there. Like I'm one of those people that when Blair Witch came out, I was not on the Blair Witch bandwagon before it made $400 million and people said it's the scariest film ever because they thought it was real.
Right.
Blair Witch, for those seeking contact, was made for about $16,000, shot on 16mm, I think back in
99.
It
was released 99.
Okay. So, and everyone thought it was one of the first found footage films. And for a while, the marketing department effectively sold it like this is real and we're actually just going to release it to the public. And for about 5 minutes, people went to the film thinking they were watching something that had actually been discovered on video.
Right.
And that had been sort of edited and laced together and then released. And in that way, I guess it was effective. I saw Blair Witch and I was completely uninterested and irritated and bored and not afraid at all. Not afraid at all. But, you know, with films like Frailty, with films like Paranormal Activity, it's proof that it's really about the carpenter as much as or more than the tools. It's about can you frame the shot? Do you know what scares people? Are you in touch? Do you relate to your audience? Are you, timing is everything in a horror movie. And people who can take the most basic of gear and they can take you to very dark places very effectively. And then you see films like The Haunting, which cost $100 million and had Catherine Zeta-Jones in it. And the scariest thing about that was the fact that I paid, you know, $12 for the ticket. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, not like the original, that's for sure. Oh my gosh.
It's not. The original with Robert Wise, the head director of the original Haunting, was so good.
And
the remake is just... it's just awful. It's just terrible.
It's hideous. Hideous.
Oh, anyway.
Deplorable.
Sorry, I'm going off on a tangent again.
Oh, no, that's what this show's all about. I should call it the Tangent Hour. That's all we do, so that's perfectly fine.
Good. No, I was going to say there's another one. I'll tell you one that's really scary.
Yes.
If you haven't, the listeners haven't seen it, and the reason it came to my mind is because I just ordered it on Blu-ray. I just got a Blu-ray thing going on in the other room, so I'm stacking up my library.
Yep.
It's called The Descent. Have you seen it?
Oh, yeah. That was fantastic.
Really, really effective movie. And it's lean and smart and darn scary. And I'm trying to figure out how to get Natalie to watch it with me. Like, honey, I'll watch Phantom of the Opera again on DVD with you. if you'll come watch Descent, The Descent with me.
Well, here's I got the here's the sales pitch. The sales pitch is easy, I think. And one of the things that I really loved about it was women, a group of women helping women out. No guys, no one coming in to rescue. The power of women. Coming together to survive. So this is a it was, to me, it was one of the early, all woman powerful horror films.
well cast, well acted, and
Indeed.
it's the kind of movie where in the last 40 minutes I'm conscious of the fact that I've stopped breathing. Like I had to actually tell myself, you need to breathe, Seth. You need to take oxygen into your lungs and breathe. And that's, I mean, that's, they've got the hook set when
Sure.
you start talking to yourself. Breathe, breathe, The Descent is, it's a fantastic little film. And I'm always on the hunt for little gems out there. If someone knows of something that's, often it's the stuff that doesn't make a squillion dollars at the box office, but it's, it's out there in the ether that someone brings to your attention that those are the films. And then there's some fun, campy horror films. Like I love Planet Terror, which was directed by Robert Rodriguez, and it's a crap movie. It's not a good movie. I watch it every time it's on. I
Yeah,
watch it every time.
it's fun. Yeah, there's those movies that you don't mind checking your brain at the door and just going for the ride and having a good time,
You
So.
just all right, we'll play movie cliche bingo. I'm okay. It's all, I'll just sit back and I watch it every time it's on. I'm just one of those guys.
Oh, that's
But
excellent.
my we call it bubble gum for the brain, and I think everybody needs that. You need to
Yeah.
find something that distracts you, that you enjoy, whatever that is. Don't apologize for it, because trust me, the people who make fun of those who enjoy horror movies, they'll blow half a day on the golf course. You know what I'm saying? The people who play, and the people who play video games are laughing at the guys who play golf, and the people who crochet are laughing at the people who play video games. But the truth is, everybody needs to find what they love, what distracts them, what rings their bell, and go do that. Just do you, be you. And if you've got that, it's a nice way to sort of cope with the rest of the often insane real world. We all have to check out and sometimes get that bubble gum for the brain.
I love that. That's perfect. Well, on that note, then, I'm going to ask you my big final question. All right, here we go. People hate this one because it, well, you'll find out. You've because of your radio personality, because the Thinking Atheist is, it's renowned, it's been well received around the globe, and you've spoken so many times. What hasn't been asked of you in an interview or anything that you some a question that you want to answer, something that you've been dying to share, but no one's given you that right question or the vehicle to do so. This is it. This is it, Seth. Let it
The
out.
problem with living such an uninteresting life
Oh,
beyond
come on.
what I do is that I can't, I'm trying to think of what one question there might be. Because they've asked me about my journey, and they ask what it's
Sure.
like to live with a religious person, and they ask me what my favorite film is, and they ask me my favorite music, 80s music, and they
Good
ask
man.
me they ask me about my pets. Like I'm a dog lover and a cat lover. I'm trying to think, is there any one thing that I've ever wanted to be asked about?
Yeah, or what do you want to share? What do you want to share that you haven't had the opportunity to do so yet?
Well, more than anything else, I just hit my 50th birthday, and
Happy
you get
birthday, man.
reflective. Thanks. You get reflective, right? You're like, you start thinking, oh, wait a minute, let's do some basic math. The average lifespan of the American male is what? Okay, let's see. Where am I on this journey? Oh, okie dokie. Well, it looks like we may want to, budget your time and make sure that you're not wasting any. And I've really become more and more cognizant of two things that really been on my mind. One is that I want to make sure that I don't look back and say I didn't say what I should have said, or I shouldn't have. I didn't pursue this goal or dream because I put it off. I really don't want to be 70 whatever and regret and say, I blew it. I think I'd rather make that mistake even 100 at 100 miles an hour and at least try something. Take a risk. Like, the Ghost Stories audiobook is a big risk for me because it's so off of a lot of what I do, and it's a whole new audience, and take the journey. And I'll be honest, it's exciting slash terrifying, but it's like, you know, if it challenges me and it resonates me, and I would regret not ever trying it.
Sure.
And that's the one thing. And the second thing that's been on my mind lately is I've been cognizant of how the internet is connecting and disconnecting us as human beings at the same time. Do you ever feel
Agreed.
That? Like,
totally do. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a push-pull effect all the way.
I'm connected to people all across the planet thanks to the internet. My show goes out online all over the world thanks mm-hmm. to the internet. I have a wonderful family and support mechanism and listeners and fans thanks to the internet.
Same
and
here.
I'm not unaware of the irony when I say that in some ways I have had to back up because I don't think we are – I mean, we see – the worst of the worst, the most inflammatory headlines, the most mm-hmm. Crazy stuff from every nook and cranny on planet Earth broadcast into our Twitter feeds in real time. I don't think we're not wired for this.
Yeah.
And it becomes almost oppressive. You mm-hmm. even though in your logical brain, you know, we're living in the most civilized time in human history, and you know that things are slowly getting better. Mostly when you log on, all you see is division and fighting and pain and scandal and hate and death and blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
I myself, for my own mental health, have had to step back and make a pact with myself that I'm going to use social media, but I'm not going to allow it to sort of use me.
Exactly. Exactly. Well said.
And I want to really be about trying to humanize human beings. And I think where... instead of seeing, you know, words that were typed on an anonymous keyboard behind an icon or avatar, I want to try to find some opportunities to remember that these are flesh and blood human beings with hugely complex stories, and
yes.
maybe we can find an opportunity to de-escalate, to say I'm sorry, to listen, and to try to be a little better to each other. And I hate to sound like a Mentos commercial, but I mean, you know what I'm saying? I just want us to be nicer to each other whenever we can. And mm-hmm. and those are the things that have been on my mind lately.
Well, you know, I'm with you on that completely. And that's what I found when I was looking at Greg Palka was sending me several of your videos. Like, yeah, watch this one, watch that one. And I'm watching them, and I thought it was great because I they were soothing. You know, I felt comfortable, you know, instead of, you know, where I would see other things and feel like, you know... almost like a call to action because something was wrong with me. You know what I mean? And so I like what you're doing. I think that transcends into what you create. So
very kind. Thank you for that. I had someone tell me the other day that they said, I listen to you when I'm going to sleep. And I'm still not sure how to respond to that. I'm like, thank you. I don't know. But no, it means a lot. I really do. And thanks for the opportunity to kind of go off topic and talk about some of the stuff I enjoy outside of my my activism. This is a ball. I may have to hook up. We'll rendezvous maybe when it comes October. I'll have you on my show. We'll talk horror movies and ghost stories again for my audience. I think it'd be fantastic.
I would be honored. So thank you very much. And please let me know when this ghost stories book is out, because the audiobook, because people are going to love it.
As it is written, so shall it be done, my friend. Thank you.
Well, Seth, before we go, why don't you tell people where they could find you?
I'm easy to find. All the work that I produce, video and podcast, are at thethinkingatheist.com, or you can go to sethandrews.net. So thethinkingatheist.com is probably the best resource if you mm-hmm. want to listen to radio, watch some video, and link to everything else.
Oh, well, you keep it simple. I like that.
You betcha.
You could find me at CrashPalaceProductions.com for links to this show and other horror-based articles. And, of course, yeah, iTunes, so don't forget us there. And, Seth, thank you so much for coming on today. This was fantastic.
It's a real honor. My pleasure. Hope we can do it again sometime, okay?
Absolutely, because it's the last knock, but you don't have to knock if you want to come on again. Just let me know. Bill, the book's out. I want to come on and talk about it. It's done. So
sounds good. I'll be here.
All right. Thank you so much. You have a great day, and my best to your wife.
You bet. Thank you.
All righty. Bye.